This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
In the second programme in our Speaking Ill of the Dead series, Dr. Pat Wallace, director of the National Museum, turns his attention to one of his predecessors, Adolf Marr, who was appointed to the job in the 1930s, but whose activities on behalf of the Nazis tend to overshadow his achievements as a curator. Dr. Wallace, who of course first came to prominence himself when he led the archaeological investigation into the Wood Quay finds in Dublin, takes a Mark Antony approach to Marr on the basis that the evil that men do lives after them, the good is oft interred with their bones.
What I feel about Dr. Marr is he's a tragic figure, a man who should have stayed away from politics. Every museum director should be friendly with every politician that ever wore a suit of clothes, no matter what ilk. But you mustn't get involved with any of them. You can't get into the cage with the tiger. He did, and he paid the price, and he is vilified accordingly. That's why I normally like to show the good points of him in relation strictly to his career in the National Museum of Ireland, where he was a wunderkind. But he was a disaster in his life as a result of his embrace of the odious politics of the Nazis. Sadly, he was a Nazi, but look at all the good he did in this institution and for Irish archaeology, of which I regard him as the scientific founder and father, and then show you the bad in him. But I'm pleased to say, for all the bad of his political embrace, it wasn't one of anti-Semitism. That's the only mitigating factor in the embrace of his form of Nazism. Marr, what did he do, the good? He came to Ireland, he started work in the National Museum in 1927. We all remember 1927, of course. There was an election late that year. It was also the year of the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins. Marr landed in Ireland. We in the Free State needed new expertise. We weren't going to go back to the old enemy for it, so we got it from Germany mainly. The army band, the sugar company, the whole electrical system, Siemens Hubert, all came from Germany. So did the director of the museum, or so did the keeper. He wasn't appointed as director. Marr spent the first 7 years of his life as keeper of Irish antiquities in the National Museum. He only became director in 1934. And that was in De Valera's time. And there's a link, actually, among some writers to link Marr with De Valera. And that's extremely unfair to both men, and particularly to De Valera. De Valera admired the scholarship. He admired the idea of the National Museum. He was a great supporter of archaeology to the end of his life. He had a son, a most distinguished archaeologist. And to say that he in somehow favoured Nazism because of that is the implication of some of these writings, and it's very unfair on his relationship with Marr. The workload was ginormous when he came to the museum. He writes about it, I'll quote it in a moment. He has dealings with the various departments, acquires new artefacts. He multiplies the intake of artefacts into the National Museum several fold. He organizes the whole archaeological museum, its habitating, its provenancing, all based on the recommendations of the Lytberg report done at the behest probably of Owen McNeill, who was Minister for Education in the Free State early on. Dr. Marr was responsible for bringing the Harvard Archaeological Mission to Ireland, and they did a series of archaeological excavations involving new archaeological techniques for the first time to the highest quality in the world. And that was done in the 1930s. Tying in with that, De Valera set up relief schemes for the unemployment, and Marr conducted that and did the accounts for all of the workmen on all of those excavations all over the island. As well as that, the new National Monuments Act was brought in 1930 by the Free State, and Marr was one of the main authors of that. Central to Dr. Marr is, as it is in my philosophy, for insofar as I'd like to be coupled in any way with such a great person in the museum sense, and that is the belief that folk life is part and parcel of archaeology, the belief that the living traditions and uses of equipment in a traditional way and built of traditional materials are a continuum with archaeology and archaeology artefacts, That's central to Marr, and Marr, in a way, is the founder of the Folklife Division in the National Museum. He is also central in the internationalization of museum discoveries and of Celtic archaeology. His publications are enormously important. He has 78 major papers printed in Austria, Germany, England, Ireland, and Spain. They range from books and papers, academic journals, and short articles. His catalogue of two-volume catalogue of the archaeological sites, the archaeological Celtic site, the early Celtic site at Hallstatt in Austria before he came. A third of all his output, written output. He was indefatigable, day and night he was working. He had a third of all of his work is devoted to work connected directly with the National Museum. The Free State government got him to do a special album of Christian art in ancient Ireland, which was written in 1932 and I suppose ironically launched gladly by Eamon de Valera, who of course also was the political presence at the Eucharistic Congress. But that Eucharistic Congress album, written by Marr, is the first really scientific insight into the Christian art of Ireland and is the forerunner of the work of Françoise Henri and her more modern successors. He also wrote on the Alto Tate Cauldron, which is one of the great wooden cauldrons in the National Collection. He is the first person to emphasize the importance of pollen diagrams and was instrumental, after a conversation with Sean McEntee, the minister, in setting up a quaternary studies program, a pollen diagram studies on the bogs of Ireland, and that in itself is where Frank Mitchell was the boy graduate brought in under Cnut Jessen in that job. As well as that, he's the only Irish-based scholar to have become president of the British Prehistoric Society. He became president of that, and his presidential address there is about 300 pages long. It's a state-of-the-art snapshot of Irish archaeology and what he had done to revolutionize that subject in 1937. What a phenomenal achievement that paper is. Because the Marr family gave me all their papers, we now have every step and stage in the preparation of that monumental work. As I see it, it's important for three reasons. It is the first chronological assessment of Irish chronological and environmental implications and of the new technique of pollen analysis. It represents the first explicit attempt to apply tenets of cultural historical archaeology to Ireland. That would be what I'm talking about, the seeking to identify peoples with practices and surviving artefacts. That is why you often see Indo-European tribes being identified to particular artefact groups and distributions, and indeed to the continuum of folklife practice as well, and related to geography. That's the German state-of-the-art approach to archaeology in the 30s. Marr brought it here and revolutionized the subject, and the legacy of that subject, of course, is still with us. But there's more to Marr as the museum man than all of that, and than academic communication. He wrote for the newspapers all the time. And in fact, popular communication, I think, is part and parcel of any museum person or any archaeologist in the country who doesn't talk to the Mayo News or the Limerick Leader should be shot, who are so ivory tower that they're writing for about three people instead of explaining to a journalist from Clare FM or wherever that so this is the age of this site, these are the kind of people buried here, and this is the kind of life that went on at that time. Marr was the introducer of that tradition. He wrote for every newspaper, he wrote for the national dailies, but he also wrote, of course, for small papers around the countryside. He began the use of radio in Ireland. Radio Éireann, or Radio Athlone, in the 30s, was used extensively by Marr, and I'll come back to that if there's a few moments in a minute. He befriended Robert Flaherty, the maker of The Man of Iron, and he was the scientific advisor during the making of The Man of Iron, where he befriended John Keating, the painter. He also trained assistants. Now, they didn't all work out what assistants do, but one did. Jean-Pierre Riordan was his star assistant, and Jean-Pierre was sent all over Europe under Marr to meet all Marr's connections in Germany and France, and particularly Scandinavia, and he came back to really be the first Irish, quality Irish-born archaeologist. The legacies of Marr can be said that he identified the needs of the museum and its archaeology. He introduced and implemented practices of museology. He dreamed the dream of someday we having a campus of sites for the various national collections. We realised it at Collins Barracks and in Castle Bar with our folk life, but it wasn't his fault. He dreamed the dream that the Viceregal Lodge, which is now Aras an Uachtaráin, would be the centre of the whole cluster of National Museum buildings. Marr prepared all the drawings, drew the tram lines on the ground where they should go, and all of that didn't happen, sadly, and we were neglected for 70 years. No longer, unless this is going out live. He internationalized archaeology and museology and went to conferences all over the world, brought people like Bronsted from Scandinavia and the great Germans all came here. Abbe Breil was here in the 30s in his time. They knew him personally. He also knew the top British archaeologists as well as Paul Jacobstall, and Hawkes in Oxford was a great friend. And Gordon Child, many of you are archaeologists, you will know his name. Gordon Child was the only one to refer to him as Dear Adolf in letters and signed himself by his own Christian name. Anyway, I suppose the main legacy of him is the impact his kind of archaeology has had on the people who have carried on the torch, like, for instance, Michael Deignan in Galway, and to some extent Rory de Valera, but Jean-Pierre Riordan, big time, in UCD. They carried on his kind of archaeology. Howard Kilbride-Jones is another one of the people influenced by him. That's one of the main legacies, the kind of archaeology and the kind of training and the use of folk life with archaeology, the recognition of radio. These are the great legacies of Marr. In 1933, Marr writes to Bender, the man who's about to give this great Oriental collection to Ireland. Bender says, "You were right in saying there's something wrong with the world. These are days of chaos and the reversion of an enlightened nation like Germany to the 14th century barbarism is so atrocious that one loses confidence in the progress of the human race. Such conduct on the part of Germany is turning the hands of the clock back 400 or 500 years." Now Marr got incensed. He blew a gasket because a few days later he says, "I am as conscious of my German nationality as you certainly are of your bonds of allegiance. And if I look at the different territories, which I know rather well, territories inhabited by some 16 million Germans who are today subject to Czech, Polish, etc. rule under the terms of the so-called peace treaties, which were announced at the final readjustment of the, in inverted commas, crimes committed by the Central Powers, you will perhaps understand that I am thin-skinned and that we cannot well be expected to swallow contemptive terms in addition to the mistreatment which was meted out to us. I sincerely hope that the quarrel between the present," this is 33 now, the year Hitler came into power, and the year that Marr joined the Nazi party, "between the German government and Jury would not have entered our correspondence. I have never alluded to the fact that, after all, there was a thing called the Balfour Declaration, 1916, by which international Jury was enlisted to support the anti-German cause. And I've never alluded to the fact that the Germans have a very great grievance against America in the question of the 14 points, which were flagrantly turned into their very opposite without scruples or conscience." But then he says, this is Marr writing back, "But you are not Mr. Wilson or Mr. Trotsky, and I am not Mr. Hitler. Why can't we discuss pleasant things in which we both take a common and purely human interest?" And this is a very telling remark then, he says, about the Irish. And this is true, of course, of the Irish. Dare we say it. "The Irish have filled the whole world for several centuries with their grievances. Could anybody expect that a people 20 times as numerous would silently rot away in misery and humiliation in order as not to disturb the equanimity of the powers and people that are responsible for the 1919, in inverted commas, treaties that were offered at the point of the sword after a most inhuman blockade, which was carried on for a half year after armistice and which put hundreds of thousands of children, old people, etc., to death. Now, Marr, you can see the pitch of his sincerity, fanaticism perhaps, but also the danger he was putting at bequest with a benefactor at risk. The old Jew in California writes back, your letter was a great surprise to me. he says, the truth is, I was only, I can see him saying it. The truth is that I was only conscious of the fact that I was writing to a gentleman of foreign origin. Anyway, he goes on, he's very angry. Marr gets back again at him on this. And Marr is particularly anti-French. But then, I just in this section, I just want to say, there are several letters about various Jews Marr is trying to help, including a goldsmith's apprentice who became a very great archaeologist, a man called Dr. Alphonse Barbe, who he tried to help. And he said, Dr. Barbe is willing to take any job, and so is his wife, and they wouldn't mind coming as a cook or a domestic servant to America. Now, Marr is trying to have it both ways, because he says recent developments in Austria deprived him of his career, and recent developments all over Europe preclude any possibility of finding for him a position anywhere in Europe. I've tried very hard in many countries, and all efforts were in vain. But he can make the connection that it's the very political party that he espouses and supports is the cause of Dr. Barbe's unfortunate predicament. Just to finish, really, I want to read the position of Dr. Marr in the Nazi organization in Ireland from Dr. Dave O'Donoghue's little pen picture. Dr. Marr lived from 1887 to 1951. By the way, at the end of the war, he was a British prisoner of war and appears to have been badly treated. He lost several stone weight and was really, if you see pictures of him after the war, he was in a bad way. But he was only in jail for about 6 months. So was his son, Gustav, by the way, in jail. But he was very lucky. He was an American prisoner of war, and he now speaks with an American accent, of course. Anyway, Dave O'Donoghue's description is, an Austrian archaeologist, Marr left Vienna, the Vienna Museum of Prehistory, in 1927 to join the museum as keeper of Irish antiquities. He joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and was promoted to the post of director in July 1934. As head of the Nazi Ausland Organisation, foreign organization in Ireland, Marr was the most prominent member of the small pre-war Austro-German community in Dublin. He spent the war years in Berlin working on the Irish desk at the Foreign Office. That's the important thing. And then, in effect, he controlled all Germany's radio propaganda to neutral Ireland from November 41 to May 45. Now, Dave's fabulous book also describes a more odious character altogether, in my opinion, called Ludwig Mühlhausen. Ludwig Mühlhausen was a folklore scholar who actually has published in our Society of Antiquaries journal and in the Cork journal, as far as I know. Now, Mühlhausen was the real ringer. Mühlhausen was the man who became chair of Celtic Studies in Berlin University, where he, among his staff was Francis Stewart, the writer. Mühlhausen broadcast in Irish most Sunday nights from December 39 to mid-41. Marr was extremely friendly with von Ribbentrop in London, the ambassador, the Nazi ambassador, German ambassador to London. For instance, Marr was at the coronation of King George VI in London in 1936, it was, I think, and there was no German ambassador those few months in Dublin. Marr outranked in Dublin the top-ranking Berlin diplomat, the ambassador, or as it was called, minister. The ambassador would have had to report to Marr before anybody because of the Nazi way of doing business. And Marr also was responsible for getting rid of two very senior men from Dublin. So there was a bad side there. I mean, one of the men, his only sin was, well, both their sins was, that they were Nazi enough, I suspect, putting it in modern English. One of them was von Daenschmidt. All von Daenschmidt did was kiss the papal nuncio's ring when he was leaving the final farewell party, and Marr is blamed by Colonel Duggan for photographing that and sending it away to Germany, and Mr. Von Dane Schmidt suffered accordingly because of that. And the other man that was brought back was Erich Schröter, who was sent home as well because of Mahr's intervention. So he may have been a benign museum director achieving wonderful things, but there is, I'm afraid, another side. Now, here's an intriguing thing from Dave O'Donoghue's book, and it really shows the level to which some of these senior Nazis went. As we know, Dr. Mahr left Ireland in September 39. Now, he went officially, as far as the museum and the department were concerned, he went to a conference on archaeology in Berlin. Fine. But he also wanted to take a few days extra leave to stay long enough for the rally at Nuremberg. So that's really another reason. And the question is then, did he get marooned in wartime Germany and was unable to come back? Or more likely, in my opinion, having read the authorities, he chose to take his wife and children and everybody with him and to stay in Germany knowing the war was coming. He wasn't the only one who left Ireland in the last days of August 39. So he knew, he must have known the war was coming. But one very interesting thing is, 3 days after Mahr left, there were officers copying one of the most suspicious letters ever mailed to Mahr's Dublin address. It was from SS officer Friedrich von Weinersgrün, Weingreen, I suppose it would be in English. He is writing from Prague. He indicates that Mahr may have supplied maps. Now, there's this whole mythology to this very hour in the National Museum of Ireland. Did some of the maps in the National Museum, we have the two editions of the Ordnance Survey, 6-inch sheets, did some of those finish up in Germany, courtesy of Mahr, with a view to helping any kind of operations, aerial reconnaissance or otherwise, landings? I have gone over this with Mahr's son in Berlin. He claims not. My belief is that there weren't any, but here is somebody thanking him for maps from the SS point of view. The neutrality of Ireland is well discussed, and the importance of that to the Germans was emphasised in papers written by Mahr in Berlin. The bombing of the Nordstrand in 41 led to Mahr getting a higher position in Berlin because they felt they had to shower Ireland with kindness and explanation, and the only way you could do that in 39 was on the radio. Well, I hope RTE Radio and myself do one thing, and that is to use the script that Mahr wrote for himself and Dr. Oke Campbell from Uppsala. If we got, say, someone like Peter Jankowski to play Mahr with a lovely German accent, and to get somebody to play Oke Campbell, who I have been told whose English was terrible. Mahr's English was good, but very Austrian German. But here are these two men in the museum in 1937 at the opening of the first Folklife Museum exhibition ever in the National Museum. One German, one Swede, and here they are in the most stilted, scripted form, reading out answers and questions to one another for a live link-up with Radio Athlone. But it must have been awful listening, but compulsory for anybody with pride in the museum and where we were going. And, of course, we were only children, teenagers, as regards national independence. And the idea of a Swede and a German talking about farm implements, cocks of hay and turf must have been the most uplifting thing. Beat an All-Ireland final any day, that kind of thing. I just feel that the use of words like notorious and a mole in the National Museum, and this is not Dave O'Donoghue, this is Mr. Dublin, and that they were well placed, he was well placed to promote Nazi propaganda in the museum. The Germans, however, still arrogantly rode roughshod over Irish economic sensibilities, but were blind to the effects of their boorish behaviour. They blamed everyone but themselves when things went wrong. That may all be true, but it's not the kind of language you expect from a historian. In fairness to Mr. Duggan, I think it's Colonel Duggan, he does a great job on the ring-kissing incident and the papal nuncio and the shafting, as he calls it. Shafting him gave Mahr a chance to curry favour with these master racists in Berlin. And Mahr also is shown as proceeding to add insult to injury by complimenting somebody whom he was about to send back to Germany. Anyway, Estyn Evans, somebody of enormous importance, a Welshman who really is the founding figure of folklife and archaeology, really, north of the border. He had become fairly friendly with Marr, but he later wrote in his own memoirs that he never thought that when he was showing Marr some items in Court Cairns in County Down and that kind of thing, Marr might have been marking the locations down. Estyn Evans never thought that he was a Nazi spy then. I think a Nazi spy isn't quite the word for it. Nazi sympathiser. The final very interesting little giblet of information in the memoirs of Estyn Evans are that Marr was initially tempted to become a Quaker. I think Marr's problem after the war, and I know this is controversial, is that he was a Protestant. Had 99.9% of Austrians who aren't or weren't Jews are Catholics. But Marr was that 1%, he was a Protestant. And I just wonder, would there have been a bit more sympathy for him had he been a Catholic? Because he certainly wasn't secreted out of Germany. He was given a job in the mining museum in Bonn, where he died of a heart attack. He made many attempts to come back. He was blitzed in the Dáil by James Dillon, TD of Fine Gael, who on several occasions cross-hackled Tom Derrick, the Minister for Education, about the whereabouts of Marr and to stop all attempts of Marr to be returned to his old job in Kildare Street. That's a story for another day, but there was no coming back for Marr. I do think that he was an unfortunate man. His whole problem stemmed from the fact that he was a native of the part of Austria, the South Tyrol, which was given to Italy at the end of World War I under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. Now, the actual enactment or commencement of those deals didn't start until the late 20s, a period when Marr was a mature man. He was 40 when he came to Ireland, so he was incensed that his homeland was given over to another country, and that's why he, I suspect, joined the Nazi party. But he seems to have gone along with most of its beliefs, and therein lies the very bad part of him. But let's not forget the good.
Dr. Pat Wallace, director of the National Museum, on one of his predecessors, Adolf Marr. Next week, Professor Terry Dolan of the School of English and Drama at University College Dublin talks about the medieval Archbishop Richard Fitzrafe of Dundalk.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.